This is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, and we're certainly finishing up the year with a bang because Dr. Sophie's guest this week is Professor Mark Birch Machin, founder of Skin Life Analytics and a professor in molecular dermatology. And Mark's interest and expertise is in the role that various lifestyle stressors play on skin aging, specifically focused on the role of sunlight, but a host of other things too, and the role of the mitochondria. All will be explained in a really simple, easy to understand way, I promise. And what's really useful is to hear Mark and Sophie also explain some of the ways in which our skin ages.
They're like the living dead, as it were. So that's why they're called zombie cells.
Plus, what we can do about it and what we should do about it.
The thickness at which we apply sunscreen never matches what you were supposed to apply.
And we get to hear Mark's own story, which is truly fascinating.
And I told them the story, told them the idea, and they said, has anyone ever done that? Has anyone proven that? I said, no. But if you employ me, then I'll give it a go.
And what an inspiring story he's got. Listen, enjoy the episode. And by the way, next week, Dr. Sophie returns with a brand new season, a new look and feel, and a host of fabulous guests. For now, we'd both like to wish you a very happy new year. Thank you for listening. And let's all go into 2025 with the tools and inspiration we need to age well, both inside and out.
Professor Mark Birch Machin is the founder of Skin Life Analytics and has been a professor in molecular dermatology for over 30 years, with a keen interest in the role that various lifestyle stressors play in skin aging. His research is specifically focused on the role of sunlight, pollution, sleep, and genetic mitochondrial dysfunction all have on the skin. And if you were keeping up with me until I used that very last phrase, please don't worry, we'll unpack and explain all of this for you, including Mark's pioneering research into the mitochondria's role in skin aging. Today, Skin Life Analytics offers non-invasive testing that can test and track how our skin is aging at its deepest subcellular level, or as their website puts it, making the invisible visible, which from my perspective as a clinician is ideal for understanding whether a patient might need any lifestyle or treatment interventions. You can find out more at skinlifeanalytics.com and also follow the team on Instagram at skinlifeanalytics. Just to also add, as part of his work, Mark has also received the prestigious Society of Cosmetic Scientists Lifetime Achievement Award. So it's a great pleasure to have you here with us, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
I think that for the benefit of our listeners, if it's okay, I'll do a super quick explainer on a few basic areas of biology. First, just as the body is made up of various organs, our cells also have their own little organs or organelles that perform particular functions. And one of these is the mitochondrion, or mitochondria plural. And the mitochondria are often referred to as the battery packs of our cells. So they work by converting food into energy that powers our cells. And that power is called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. And our DNA, which is something else we'll talk about in a moment, is like an instruction manual for our bodies with a genetic code that's unique to each of us. And the information in our DNA is hereditary, meaning it passes from parents to children. But Mark, again, in super simple terms, if you can, for our listeners, can you go into a bit more detail on the mitochondrial DNA and how this is different to our genetic DNA or our nuclear DNA?
Essentially, mitochondria are the batteries of our cells, so the power packs of our cells. And so each cell in our body actually has mitochondria. Now, the number of mitochondria will differ depending on the tissue. So, for example, in brain and muscle, which require a lot of energy, there'll be a lot more mitochondria than something like skin, but actually skin still has a lot of mitochondria per cell. And within the mitochondria, there is a DNA molecule, which is circular. And unlike the DNA we get from our parents, which is the nuclear DNA, our mum and our dad, mitochondrial DNA is a lot smaller, very much smaller. And interestingly, it only comes from our mother. So mitochondrial DNA is maternally transferred. And this DNA inside the mitochondria is very different to the nuclear DNA, the DNA we get from our mums and dads, because essentially it's naked. In other words, it doesn't have any protein clothes on it. which our nuclear DNA has. And so because of that, it gets damaged very easily. And there are other aspects we'll go into, but essentially it's easily damaged. And because of that, it can be used as a biomarker or a diary of the trauma that our cells receive.
I think that's fascinating. And thank you for summarizing that really succinctly and well. We know that healthy cells grow and divide to replace aging or damaged cells in the body. Can you explain to listeners how skin ages, including a brief and super simple explainer on things like telomeres, senescence, how ATP declines, but also the role of mitochondrial DNA in skin aging? Because lines and wrinkles are a sign of mitochondrial damage, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. Every morning when we look in the mirror, we're actually the best judge of how we're aging and how we're treating our skin. Skin is an easy tissue to look at in terms of aging. Clearly, as we get older, all the tissues in our body age and are subject to the same kind of stressors. But skin is great because actually we can see our skin, we can see what's going on, and it's actually the largest organ in the body, and we can actually see whether or not the things that we do to skin makes the aging skin look better or worse. And so in terms of the mechanisms, many people have heard about these words like telomeres and senescence, and now we've heard a new word today, mitochondria, and they all kind of work together as part of the aging process. Now, senescence, I would just easily describe that as zombie cells. Your listeners might have heard of the term zombie cells. In other words, cells that have the appearance of life, but have really stopped dividing. So they're kind of like the living dead, as it were. So that's why they're called zombie cells. Telomeres are the ends of our DNA, and really they're there just to keep the DNA from unraveling. It's almost like having a shoelace, you know, when the little ends just falls off and our shoelaces tend to unravel a little bit. Well, telomeres are like that. And as we get older, the telomeres get shortened. And so our DNA becomes more vulnerable to being, as it were, unwound or unwrapped. And because of that, then it's more susceptible to damage. And then finally, we have our mitochondria. And actually, mitochondria are really the center of a lot of aging theories. And there's something called the vicious cycle of aging, which sounds awful, doesn't it? Which really mitochondria are at the center of it. And it describes how the exhaust fumes, as it were, of mitochondria, which is the oxidative stress, increases as we age. And that oxidative stress then damages the DNA inside our mitochondria, which then affects how the mitochondria function. And as we've heard, Sophie, in your introduction, that mitochondria make the ATP, make the energy of the cell. So if they're dysfunctional, therefore they make less energy, and that then feeds into more stress because it kicks out more exhaust fumes and the whole cycle just gets carried away, which actually accelerates the aging process, which is basically our batteries wearing down and the exhaust fumes, that oxidative stress, increasing.
I know people may say it's a well-worn message that sun damage creates or causes skin aging. But can we break that down a little bit and talk about UV light and how this impacts the different layers of the skin?
Sure. And within aging, we have external stressors and internal stressors. And I'm sure we'll get onto the internal stressors a little bit later. But external stressors of skin, you've got two main factors: pollution, environmental pollution, and sunlight. And so within sunlight, you've got UV, ultraviolet light, you've got visible light, and then you've got infrared. And certainly the UV can be divided into the shorter wavelength UVB and the slightly longer wavelength UVA. And they will differentially penetrate into the skin. What does that mean? That means the shorter wavelengths, UVB, will only really hit the epidermis, the upper layer of the skin, whereas the longer wavelength UVA will penetrate deeper into the skin. And in some cases, depending on what papers you read, it can actually just about reach the dermis, which is the lower aspect of the skin where a lot of the aging changes come from.
Hello, Mark. This is Fee. I'm just listening, so impressed by both of you, actually, for explaining all of this to somebody like me that has always struggled with biology and some of these concepts. So thank you so much. I assume, Mark, therefore, because of everything that you're saying, that you're an advocate for sunscreen. Is this a key intervention if we go into a more solutions-focused part of our discussion? Is this a key intervention if we want to mitigate aging?
Yes, absolutely. And I think sunscreen is a very effective tool, and obviously combined with lifestyle factors as well. But let's just focus on sunscreen. And yeah, big advocate. I used to do a lot of marathon running, marathon training, and that means you spend a lot of time outside in sunlight, and you get very good at finding out which sunscreens run into your eyes and which don't, etc., etc.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on sunscreen application? How often we should use it, how we should reapply it, what factor to use? Sophie did a great episode on this earlier on this year at the time of recording, but I would love to get your thoughts on sunscreen.
Yes, absolutely. And I did listen to Sophie's podcast, actually. So I would recommend that.
You.
Fantastic. That podcast should be on many sites that should refer to it, because I think you just cover everything, really.
Thank you.
In a really good depth. And I think you highlighted this aspect of application frequency and thickness as well. And so the thickness at which we apply sunscreen never matches what you were supposed to apply, because if we're being technical, you're supposed to apply sunscreen at 2 mg/cm². Now, I would challenge anyone, even in the industry, and I have spoken to a lot of people in the industry, I don't think I've ever come across anyone that's applied sunscreen at 2 mg/cm² on a regular basis, all right, because it is really thick, right? And actually, there's been a lot of studies. Brian Diffie did a fantastic study where he actually found out the fact that most people apply sunscreen about 40 to 60% thickness compared to the 2 mg/cm². So already you've halved the thickness of the recommended application dose of your sunscreen. So you're getting less of a protection. So if on most skin cancer sites, everything else, they've now recommending SPF 30. There was a few sites a few years ago that used to do SPF 15, which thankfully that's disappeared now, but SPF 13. So people say, well, Mark, what do you recommend? Well, I always go higher, because actually knowing the fact that if you go SPF 50 or something like that, most people will put the sunscreen on less thickly than they should. And as Sophie was explaining in her podcast, in terms of the difference between SPF 30 and 50, the percentages, you're looking in the 90s, the high 90s. But actually, over a lifestyle, putting sunscreen on less thickly will actually have an effect. So you may as well go big, go large, go SPF 50, because that's a way of actually allowing for the fact you're going to put on sunscreen less thickly. But also in terms of application, again, it depends on what you do in terms of frequency. Some companies recommend 4 hours, some recommend 2 hours. Obviously, if you're on the beach, you're going out, you're toweling down, you should reapply after you towel down. If you're doing vigorous activity, you know, outside, running, tennis, those kind of things, again, sweat is just going to decrease the amount of coverage that you have. And so be mindful of the type of activity that you're doing, and don't be a slave to essentially what's written on the bottle or whatever way, saying, well, it's 4 hours. So even though I've been tanning off in and out of the sea and everything else, I'm not going to do anything for 4 hours. Well, you've actually wiped off a lot of the sunscreen. So again, be mindful of the activities that you're doing outside.
Do you wear it year round, daily?
Well, it depends again what you're doing. I mean, to be honest, the incident light and everything else, it decreases from about September to about March, April. But I do a lot of traveling abroad in the wintertime. So most people get sunburn actually at home rather than abroad, because somehow we feel that the sun is different here than it is abroad. I mean, there are differences in latitudes and incident light and all that. But actually, just because we feel we're in the UK and we're doing gardening in the spring, things like that, or late autumn, and it's a hot day, we just feel that it's not going to burn us. So I think be mindful of the fact of the sun will still burn in the UK. The sun is still the same whether you're here or in a different part of the world. The incident light may be different, the fractions of UVA, UVB. And also be mindful that you can get sunburn on a cloudy day. Go walk in the Lake District. The clouds will filter out the infrared wavelengths, which actually give the warming aspect of the sun, but the UV light will still penetrate. Okay, it's filtered out a little bit, but because the clouds filter out the longer wavelengths, we feel we're safe because we're not feeling the warming effects of the sun, but still the UV is still getting through, which is why we can get sunburn on a cloudy day in the Lake District.
I tend to wear my sunscreen all year round, but I think that's sort of when you have a good formulation, it can't do any harm. It's still protecting against UV, even though we have less of it through the winter. But I think also there are some people who I hear say, oh, don't wear sunscreen in winter because it will help you to boost your vitamin D levels. That's just not true, because the UVB just isn't strong enough in from September to probably about May for us to make our own UVB. And so I think that's not a good reason not to wear it.
No, I agree. And actually, there's been some great studies where people have actually looked at patients with XP, xeroderma pigmentosum. And because of that, they have to be indoors, right? Because they have a 2,000 to 3,000-fold increase of getting skin cancer. In America, they're called moon children. Children with XP are called moon children because they only go out at night. And actually, there's been some excellent studies looking at vitamin D levels in patients with XP. And through vitamin D, you know, eating the right type of food with enriched vitamin D and everything else, that the vitamin D levels are maintained at a very acceptable level in people that actually cannot go out in the sun. And so I agree with you, Sophie, is the fact that actually we should be getting our vitamin D mainly from our diet, and we shouldn't be doing this yo-yo effect of being in the winter sun, summer sun, shall I, shan't I, and all this kind of stuff. So yes, having a sun protection regime within application, facial application, I think is a great idea.
Can you talk about the ways that Skin Life Analytics is able to test and track skin damage?
Yes. Skin Life Analytics is a spin-out company from Newcastle University. And basically that means the fact that actually the university has allowed the spin-out company to utilize 30 years of research that I've done on mitochondria, mitochondrial DNA, and using that as a biomarker or tower of predominantly sun and pollution-induced DNA damage. But mitochondria in skin will reflect the stress that your skin has received. And so because of that, we have this kind of invisible DNA damage in your skin, which is like a prerequisite to what we often see, the fine lines, wrinkles, and even skin tone that are related to the later stages of skin aging where it becomes visible, which is why we use the strap line, making the invisible visible. In other words, we can, using our technology, look at your tower or health of your mitochondrial DNA damage and give a report on that using a non-invasive skin swab. And actually that allows us to do something about it well before the visible signs become manifest.
So the skin tracking that you offer can presumably help people understand how quickly lines and wrinkles might form, but can it also identify or help with any other skin concerns such as acne or rosacea?
That's a great question. So we've not really, in our pilot studies and all the work that we've done, we've actually not looked at eczema skin, psoriasis skin. However, we do know the fact that the more people ask us questions and the more tests that we do, we actually find out the fact that the mitochondrial DNA damage, being almost like a sentinel of damage, it really is sensitive to a lot of skin interruptions and interventions. So I wouldn't say that it isn't useful in eczema psoriasis. It's just the fact that we've not looked at that yet because we're launching and cascading out this skin swab, which looks at mitochondrial DNA damage. And essentially what we're doing there is, rather than saying you've got the skin of a 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old to begin with, which we're almost at the stage where we can do, but because we want to get it completely right, we're actually doing lots of samples. What we're using is the person as their individual control. In other words, how do you start? Time zero, when you have this skin swab, that is your initial measurement. And then actually you have an intervention. It's like going to the dentist. And if a dentist says you need to do some fillings, you need to stop eating sweets. And so you stop eating sweets, you go back to the dentist and actually say your teeth are in a much better place. It's the same thing with a skin swab in the sense that we take our first measurement at time equals zero, and you would have an intervention, either it be through a clinic, whether it be topical, mechanical, combined with lifestyle as well, because obviously a bad lifestyle can overwhelm a good intervention. And then at about 12 weeks, you come back and have another skin swab. And at that point, you're able to see whether or not the condition of the DNA inside your mitochondria, which is an indicator of skin health, is actually better, worse, or the same. And that allows the clinician to either say, well, actually, this technique is really working, we can carry it on. Or if it's not working as well as we'd like to, we can pivot to another intervention at a much earlier stage than waiting until we see the fine lines, wrinkles, uneven skin tone, which takes a lot longer and actually costs a lot more. So Sophie, as a clinician, would look at that and say, well, we can have this or we can pivot to this. But the advantage to Sophie as a clinician is the fact that in a very short period of time, compared to the kind of traditional imaging methods of skin, which we use ourselves. We use machines like the Vizier and things like that, which are great. It's just the fact that actually they pick up those skin changes at the visible end, whereas we're looking at the invisible, the DNA damage. So it gives you a bigger window of intervention and choice before those aging manifestations appear. And so it gives Sophie as a clinician much more scope in actually tracking and tracing what's going on in combination with advice for lifestyle. So it's got to be both, because a great intervention can be completely outdone by a heavy smoker.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to that, because I know that lifestyle is a huge part of your protocol and your ethos in terms of preventatives beyond sunscreen, which is a big one. Should we talk about how lifestyle can prevent so-called oxidative stress? And if so, what are some of the key lifestyle interventions? You've mentioned a couple, but what would you say are the key lifestyle interventions that you would endorse?
Well, I always say self-denial and clean living. There you go. So, so clearly we mentioned sunscreen. Things about alcohol, depending on alcohol consumption, everything else, it depends on how we process alcohol. But it can deplete our antioxidant pool in our skin by a third. So if you're going out for an evening out and you're intending to drink quite a bit, you actually are depleting your antioxidant pool in your skin, which often, apart from dehydrating everything else, which is often why our skin can be looks not so great the next few days afterwards. But also it means the fact that actually our skin then is more susceptible to damage, because its antioxidant pool, the ability to buffer stress, is decreased because of our lifestyle. And so you'd want to be, I have this fortunate aspect to the fact that through Skin Life Analytics, but also through my academic career, I've worked with most of the companies that you'll probably ever want to mention on this program. And clearly I can't mention a single one, because then I'll alienate all the others. But it allows you to actually find out which ingredients are fantastic. And you'll find a lot of the good products will have niacinamide in them, vitamin B3. I've actually published papers on niacinamide in aging cells. Niacinamide is a great antioxidant, promotes proliferation, but also what it does do is it actually enhances something called mitophagy. I would describe mitophagy as taking out the recycling bins. Mitochondria are producing lots of energy, but they can get damaged. And so the process of mitophagy allows the cell to effectively take out the recycling bins, gets rid of the damaged ones. And actually niacinamide enhances that process, because actually as we get older, the ability for our cells to take out the bins declines. All right. So that's great. Ferulic acid is fantastic. Not only is it an antioxidant, but it's called a chelator or a chelator, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. What does that mean? A chelator will actually bind and mop up things like zinc and iron, things like that, particularly iron, which leads to oxidative stress. And so having free iron kicking around in our skin cells is not great, because actually it provides a platform to generate stress. And so things like ferulic acid will mop those up. Again, vitamin C and E, great antioxidants. Hyaluronic acid is well known out there for its water retention abilities, things like that. And ceramides is kind of like a glue that holds our skin together. It provides a kind of waterproof seal. All these kind of things will obviously help to keep our skin water retained. We don't lose a lot of transepidermal water loss. And actually, again, mopping up these metal ions, which lead to stress, and actually mopping up those free radicals as well, and helping our skin to take out the bins, as it were.
I love that analogy, taking out the bins. So, Mark, what's your story, and how did you come to be interested in all of this?
Yes, well, I mean, there was a kind of an epiphany moment, really. I am really 130 years old, so because it just sounds, when I start stories like this, it sounds like I've been working in science for hundreds of years. But for the first 10 years of my scientific career, I worked in mitochondrial disease, and predominantly in brain and heart and muscle, and involved in setting up diagnostic services, etc. And so that journey took me to Paris. It took me to a big city center hospital, almost like the Great Ormond Street equivalent in Paris. It's called Hôpital Necker des Enfants Malades. And so spent a year there. Wife and I moved with a two-year-old, and we spent a year in Paris. And whilst there, you're observing lifestyles, particularly in the spring and summer. A lot of Brits came over. They're sitting outside, as usual, in the sunlight. All the French were having their lunch in the shade and all the Brits were sitting outside having their lunch in the sun. And I was thinking about mitochondria are, as we alluded to before, contain DNA which is naked and so actually is very vulnerable to damage. And it has very few repair mechanisms as well compared to the DNA found in our nucleus. And so not only is it susceptible to damage, it's not really very good at repairing itself. It's like, I always liken it to a crime scene. If you have a crime scene in your nuclear DNA, there's lots of repair mechanisms. They tidy it all up generally. There are many times when it doesn't happen. But with mitochondria, there's no one tidying it up and it's a real mess. So when you go into it, the crime scene is almost as it were. And so from that point of view, I thought, I wonder what is happening to the crime scene in the Brits that are sitting out in the cafes having their mulled frites. What is going on? Because their mitochondria are recording what they're doing to their skin now. And wouldn't it be fantastic if you're able to access that diary of damage and then help that person and empower them to make decisions which would decrease that damage? And so that kind of epiphany moment then coincided with a random phone call from Newcastle Dermatology, because obviously my background was in neurodegenerative disease. And essentially, I secured a lectureship in dermatology. And in my interview, the question was, okay, what's going to be your unique selling point? Because we've got lots of applicants. What are you going to do? And I told them the story, told them the idea, and they said, has anyone ever done that? Has anyone proven that? I said, no. But if you employ me, then I'll give it a go. And history speaks for itself. If it wasn't a success, I wouldn't be on this podcast today. I wouldn't be speaking about it. And actually, it was a success. And I pioneered it first time in the world. And obviously, other people have joined in and amazing scientists and have improved other aspects to it as not. So as a team of scientists, we've carried it on. But that pioneering really first happened in Paris with that epiphany moment.
Absolutely fascinating. And it's such an exciting and innovative space and an area in which I think there's going to be so much more to come in the future. In your professional opinion, can skin damage be repaired or even reversed? And I guess more specifically, can lines and wrinkles be reversed?
Within this question, and I used to sit on the ASA in Clearcast to do with TV advertising and all this kind of stuff. And I've seen some interesting claims, put it that way. There's interesting use of the words reverse aging. I think it's safe to say you can reverse the signs of aging and you can slow the aging process down, but I've yet to be convinced that you can reverse aging per se, if that makes sense. So you can actually, as I always say, move from the fast lane of aging to the slow lane of aging. So, and actually in terms of fine lines, wrinkles, they are signs of aging. And so you can actually, by interventions, et cetera, we've seen the photos. Clearly, there can be, as it were, an apparent reversal of that situation. So you're reversing the signs of aging. But the question is, are you reversing aging itself? And I think that's a completely different question. To answer that, you'd have to go into quite detailed biology. And there's some amazing biology out there, but I think you'd almost have to be proving you get conversion of senescent cells to non-senescent cells. You'd actually have to show lengthening of telomeres. You'd have to show complete restoration of mitochondrial function, etc. Now, we've shown and studied where you can get, through various activities, which I've mentioned already, and they're in our publications, where you can treat skin cells and look at the mitochondria, and you can, as it were, shift the balance of old-looking mitochondria to younger looking functional mitochondria. So does that mean we're reversing aging? ? What we are showing is the fact that you can shift an aging phenotype to younger aging phenotype, but it's still aging. We're still aging, but you can actually shift that balance, if that makes sense.
Thank you so much for sharing so much, Mark. It's been really insightful and I think really useful for our listeners.
Thank you very much.
And that ends our podcast. If you want to explore more of what we talked about, simply head to the show notes. We've done all of the research and noting down of names, ideas, any studies we mentioned, so you don't have to go digging. To be ahead of the latest episode, press follow on Apple Podcasts. That's the little cross on the top right. Or simply hit follow on Spotify or whichever podcast app you use. Also, do follow Sophie on Instagram and TikTok. There's loads of great content and little explainers on there. Search for Dr. Sophie Schotter. Finally, if you're close to London or Kent, you can book a consultation with Sophie and find out more about who she is and the range of treatments and services she offers via drsophieschotter.com. And by the way, there's some great blog content on the website too. My name's Fiona Mattesini. On behalf of myself and Sophie, please do take a moment to rate and review the show. It all helps. And of course, thanks for listening.